from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn which illnesses are in the air in Milwaukee County and how to stay safe.
A lot of these can be avoided with vaccines, and it's not too late. You know, we're already mid-January, but we're still seeing flu and COVID ramping up, and so getting your vaccine right now is not too late a time period to get it.
Then we'll explore how museums can increase civic education. Plus, we'll explore how to stay active and social during the cold winter months.
This realization of, like, I could move somewhere warmer, or I have to realize, like, this is going to be half of our year every year. We cannot just throw out half of our year.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. There's a lot in the air these days, literally. Respiratory illnesses like flu, COVID, and RSV are all on the rise in Milwaukee. Dr. Ben Weston, Chief Health Policy Advisor for Milwaukee County, joins me to talk about the many illnesses in the air right now and how you can stay safe. Dr. Weston, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
It's good to be with you.
What are the variety of illnesses that we're seeing circulating in Milwaukee right now?
Well, we have a whole variety. I'm not sure how much time we have, but let's focus on a few of the ones that are a little more impactful. And so certainly we're seeing pretty significant rises in flu right now, as we do this time of year always. But then on top of that, we're also seeing a lot of rise in COVID. RSV levels, this is one that gives, again, flu-like symptoms, is really high right now in Milwaukee and in Wisconsin. And then we also are contending with norovirus. And if you're not familiar with norovirus, it probably means you haven't had norovirus recently because it's miserable and incredibly contagious. But we're seeing really high levels of norovirus. And that's one that comes with these sort of gastrointestinal symptoms that everybody loves hearing about on the radio, vomiting and all that kind of stuff. So these four things are probably the most predominant that are going around that kind of have a name, but then there's all the other junk that's out there, common cold and all that. And so if you haven't been sick in the last couple of weeks, you're pretty lucky.
As you look at the variety of things that we're seeing, what's most serious? I know RSV, depending on your age, can be very serious, but COVID as well, flu.
Yeah, it really depends. I would say the common factor between all of them are older or people with health conditions. So if you're in an older age group, you're more susceptible to all of these. If you have immunocompromise or lung conditions or things like that, you're more susceptible to pretty much all of these. Now, there are some special groups. RSV, we worry a lot about really young, like babies with RSV. That's why women who are toward the end of their pregnancy this time of year are eligible to get an RSV vaccine. That's a newer vaccine. It's not used as much as it should be. So if you fall into that category, you should certainly talk to your provider, to your OB or your family medicine doc about that. And then really young populations also for flu in particular, just smaller airways in little kids and babies. And so when those airways get inflamed and full of gunk, it can make it a lot harder to breathe. So there are certain populations with each of these that are more affected.
Mm. When it comes to norovirus, who should be most concerned there? Is it the same kinds of populations?
Yeah, it's the same kinds of populations. So with norovirus, a few important things to know. One is it's incredibly contagious. It's just actually a few viral particles, which when you think about it, that's not much, can make it contagious. And so being in the same room of somebody with norovirus, you can catch it. Now, the typical way to catch it is fecal-oral spread. I won't describe what that means, but if you think hard enough about it, you can probably figure it out. But that's why it's so important to wash your hands, especially after using the bathroom, before eating food. And we're talking about washing with soap and water for 20 long seconds, as opposed to just hand sanitizer. Hand sanitizer actually doesn't work very well at all for norovirus. So this time of year, you want to be washing your hands. You want to be careful. But as far as the people who get more sick, what norovirus can do is it can really dehydrate you because it involves a lot of vomiting. And so if you, again, are in an older age group, if you're in a younger age group, if you have some sort of illness already that makes you more prone to dehydration or medications that make you more prone to dehydration, you can get pretty sick with it.
So what are the ways that we can avoid these diseases in general? You mentioned, of course, washing your hands for a good 20 seconds every time. What are some of the other ways?
Yeah, so general hygienic practices go a long way. So when we're talking about things like norovirus, really when we're talking about any of them, washing your hands is going to be really important at those key time periods around using the restroom or eating are kind of the key ones. And then, you know, if you're coughing or sneezing, try to do it into kind of the crook of your elbow as opposed to your hand or somebody else's face and things like that. And then just the general rule, if you can, if you're not feeling good, if you're sick, stay home. Nobody really wants you at work if you're coughing all over the place or sneezing all over the place or, you know, vomiting all over the place. And so those are some of the kind of common sense things to do. And then, of course, we can talk more about this, but three of these diseases are vaccine-preventable illnesses. And so COVID and flu vaccine is widely available for pretty much every age group, every person. RSV vaccine is a little bit more limited to older age groups or people with health conditions or, again, pregnant women in a certain stage of their pregnancy. And so a lot of these can be avoided with vaccines. And it's not too late. You know, we're already mid-January, but we're still seeing flu and COVID ramping up. And so getting your vaccine right now is not too late a time period to get it, to get protection.
If you're someone who is around a lot of young children, should you be considering getting an RSV vaccine?
Yeah, it's a good question. So the RSV vaccine is pretty limited in who can get it. And so it's going to be people who are in an older age group, 70, 75 and older. And then you can get a little bit younger if you have health conditions, around 65. And then it's pregnant women toward the end of their pregnancy, you know, this time of year in particular. It's not offered right now for kind of those middle age groups or for caregivers and things like that. I'm sure that's something they'll be watching. It's a newer vaccine to see if it would be effective in those age groups. But right now, the purpose of the RSV vaccine, as with the purpose really of all vaccines, is to avoid that severe disease, to keep you out of the hospital. And the people who are likely to end up in the hospital are in those age groups we talked about.
So if you are currently unvaccinated, where are some of the places you can go in Milwaukee to get a vaccination?
Yes. So, I mean, in Milwaukee, one of the best places to get a vaccination is the Milwaukee Health Department. So the Milwaukee Health Department offers vaccines, especially for people who have trouble accessing vaccines otherwise. So if you have a regular doctor that you see, if you have access to a pharmacy and you have insurance, that's an easy way to do it. You can pop into your local pharmacy. They'll give you the COVID vaccine. They'll give you the flu vaccine. They'll bill your insurance for it. But if you don't have those sort of means, if you don't have insurance, if you're underinsured, if you're worried about the cost, call the Milwaukee Health Department. They have a number of different sites around Milwaukee, and they're providing these vaccines as well to make sure that everybody is getting as protected as possible.
All right. Well, Dr. Weston, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your expertise.
It was my pleasure.
Dr. Ben Weston is the Chief Health Policy Advisor for Milwaukee County and the Medical Director for Milwaukee County's Office of Emergency Management. A study from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Foundation found that 70% of Americans would fail a basic civics test. As polarization increases, a lack of civic education and understanding can lead to distrust in our government. Marquette University's Lubar Center is holding a discussion to explore how museums can play a role in improving civic education in Wisconsin. The event will be moderated by Lubar Center Director Derek Mosley. He joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to share how civics goes beyond knowing our three branches of government.
We're tackling a big topic, but an important one. It's civics. So just before we get into the weeds, what was your reaction to the survey results by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce recently? Their foundation had showed that 70% of Americans would fail a basic civic test, with particular concern for the next generation of adults. 70%, huge number.
Yeah, it was pretty shocking, actually. I knew it might be high, but 70% is a pretty ridiculous number. And when you talk about that number, it's actually not that bad amongst individuals who are like 65 and up. it just seems to be everyone below that age, and especially those who fall into the teens and early 20s, it's extraordinarily low, and it's quite shocking.
So as we break down some civics and understanding, let's establish a basic definition of civics when we're talking about this subject. So what is it, and what does it revolve around?
Yeah, so civics encompasses a whole bunch of different subjects. So it encompasses everything from history, social studies, a little poli-sci, basically letting people know how their government works, why it works, what are their rights, what are their responsibilities, which is almost as important as their rights, so that one day they will become better citizens, and then hopefully from that knowledge, seek to change the world in places where they think they could have an effect. So that's the basic definition when we talk about civics.
I really like that. It definitely goes beyond legislative, judicial, and executive branches, right? So,
And they're all in there, right?
For
that's
sure.
The little poli-sci part we talk about, but you know, it's history. Part of that study said that they asked people a simple question like, you know, who do we fight in World War II? And they were like shocked that no one knew. And another one was like, they had a multiple choice question of name one thing Benjamin Franklin did. And one of the answers was invented the light bulb, right? Which is obviously wrong, but a lot of people picked it. And so it's things like that, not knowing the history of the country, why the country was founded in the first place. It makes it very difficult when you don't know that, then how are you going to move forward and how are you going to make it a better place for all of us right now?
Exactly. And in general, in America, civics are taught from kindergarten through high school, but then is most likely an elective, maybe one basic course if you choose to not study it further in college. And you being at Marquette Law School, I'm sure you're surrounded by staff and students who perhaps have a better than average understanding of civics. But what are some contributing factors you believe are factors in the decline in civic education and general knowledge?
You know, I just thought about this question recently, and I wonder if a lot of it has to do with the fact that it seems like, Audrey, that we are in a continuous political cycle, right? No matter what, we're always talking about politics. Some elections coming up in the next couple of months, all the time. And maybe it's just the fact that people are just tired of hearing about elections all the time, right? We know it's definitely a lack of teachers, lack of teachers who are teaching this subject. It's a very specialized subject. And also, it's a lot had to do with the government itself. You know, we kind of shifted our focus, worried about the fact that we are being out-educated by China, and went to like science and math being more important than learning more about who our country was and how we were founded. And so I think it's like this perfect storm of things that happened that made it not a number one priority anymore.
Yeah, and on the note of teachers, as we continue to learn and grow as people, as educators, systems, you know, we are ideally embracing the fact that not all accounts of history are quote-unquote correct. There's more than one view. There's more than one perspective. And I think that's been a big challenge in promoting civics education because we have to address that, right, in the way that it was classically taught.
Yeah, and you know what? That's good. And it's bad, right? So for instance, you know that I'm a student of Black history. And when you talk about there's more than one version of history, that didn't used to be the case. There used to be this one version of history that was in the book that everybody read, no matter if you went to school in Wisconsin or you went to school in LA, we had the same history book and we learned from this same civics book, right? But things have changed. And I know as a student of Black history, I've noticed that there's all these stories that have been left out. You know, a lot of stories of people who didn't look like me or didn't tell the native perspective. And so now that we know that there's other stories out there, yeah, you're absolutely right. I think it's become this not one version of history exists anymore. And what you prioritize as being the most important version of that history seems to be different depending on who you talk to.
And when it comes to understanding our government, right, there's the big G government, there's the national, federal level, there's people who get involved on the local level. But this is also reflected, I feel, in our elections and our election turnouts, right? Maybe our lack of knowledge and understanding also correlates with maybe people not showing up to the polls as much or knowing the importance of their comptroller or other things like this. So do you think there are some common misconceptions about how our government works when it comes to civics and understanding as well?
Absolutely. And I don't think that is only limited to the citizenry. I used to be an elected official, and I used to be a part of one of those branches of government, right? The judicial branch. And I was surprised in my everyday work as someone who was a part of the judiciary that the other branches of government were not aware that we were a separate branch of government, right? That we weren't a department head. You know, I wasn't like Department of Public Works chairman. I didn't work for them. I was a separate elected official who represented a separate but equal branch of government. And so I don't want it to seem like it's the citizenry who don't know what's going on. Ultimately, it's all of us who don't understand the basic principles of how our government works and why we have it, why it's so important that we have these three branches of separate but equal governments to keep a check on each other, to make sure that everybody's playing by the same set of rules.
And I also think the general idea that, you know, no branches of government should be running by themselves. They all have different checks and balances on one another. But at the same time, these checks and balances aren't a self-propelled machine, right? I mean, can you share your experiences working in one yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. And elections have everything to do with that, right? So you can have your separate branches of government that have their own checks and balances on each other. But we're a political system, right? Where we have a right now just a two-party system. And depending on what party you belong to and what party's in power, that generally controls how things are viewed. So if one party has all the branches of government, right, has the executive, the judicial, and the legislative branch, well, that agenda seems to be the agenda that takes hold, right? No matter how the other side might feel about it, that agenda takes hold because those checks and balances are all being done by the people who subscribe to the same party. And so I don't know if it's ever been as polarized as it is now. Perhaps it has been. I'm quite sure in the founding of the country it was pretty polarized. But at this moment, right now, in modern history, this is pretty polarizing. And our politics have become so inflamed that it's all about getting your agenda done and not so much about taking care of everybody, not just the people who fall in your party, everybody. And that's why civics is so important. It's more than just a history book. It's more than just a political science class. It's more than all of these things. It's a combination of all these things to understand who we are, why we are, and what can we do to make this place better for all of us.
On that note, I want to address some more of the consequences of a lack of civic education for people of all ages, right? But I think one of the most pressing ones, and what you were just talking about, is that a lack of understanding also corresponds with a decline in trust in our government, which is especially evident when things are hyperpolarized.
Yeah, you know, when you live in this hyperpolarized society where it's more important about getting these wins than it really is about actually legislating, then you see things that happen like not a lot happening in the legislative cycle, right? Or the will of the people you see in these studies. The study says that, I mean, we do polls all the time at Marquette Law School, and our polls say this percentage of people agree with this thing, but then it gets to the legislature and that's not the agenda of the legislature. Despite the fact that the vast majority of people feel that way, it doesn't happen. And so when that happens, people get really upset and feel like they're not really part of this system. The system belongs to a group of people who get elected and they're not part of those people. And so they check out. And then when they check out, it leads to problems in our system from the local school board all the way up to, you know, president of the United States. So it's all together how this works. And it's all being held together by this concept that we call civics.
And if we don't have a good baseline understanding, right, of these civics, do you think this also impacts our ability to have productive conversations with people we may disagree with?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're already in this society now that we don't talk to people who are different from us anyway, right, who don't think the same way we do. So just to give you an example, I used to love to watch on the late night talk shows, right? And they would like go on the streets and they would just put a microphone in someone and say, who's the president of the United States? You know, things like that, right? And you're like, how do they find these people who don't know who the president is and all these things? But when you realize it, people have checked out. They have completely checked out. And so I look at that and I say, how can this possibly happen? But if you feel like the system isn't working for you or people aren't fighting for you or what you believe in, you check out. And what we think is unbelievable, 70% of Americans couldn't pass the basic civics test, it actually starts to make sense. when people check out, they don't pay attention. They don't have conversations with people who think differently than them. And they're in these little echo chambers that they talk to all the time. And they never confront different points of view, different issues. And you know, isn't that what school is all about? Isn't that what the education system is all about, is to get into a room of people who don't think like you and to actually talk about issues from a different points of view and learning different points of view? But we've become so polarized that no matter what we talk about, everything's so political. And it could be basic, but somehow it becomes political. And so I never thought in a million years that school board elections would be so political. You know, I thought we were all in the same boat here. We want our kids to learn and, you know, and do well in school. But that's what's happened. And we don't talk. And when we do talk, we don't talk to people who think differently than we do.
You know, speaking of schools, unfortunately, increasing civic education and the resources that go towards it, it's very localized, right? It varies from state to state, county to county. Varies across the nation. But your upcoming program is all about how museums can help. So can you share a bit more about how, you know, you're pulling in the backup and seeing how museums can help foster some better understanding here?
Yeah, absolutely. So we always kick off museum days. And so museum days happens in the city of Milwaukee, where a lot of the museums in Milwaukee are either free or have a very, very reduced cost for admission. And that's just to get people through the door, people who not only live here, but people who live all throughout the state and people who come and visit the state. And so museums and educators thought, you know, if this isn't happening in the schools, where can we fit in to educate, to fill that gap? You know, the gap that they're not getting in schools because of the lack of teachers who teach the subject or whatever it may be. And so we have a program trying to pull together all those parties from, we have a seventh grade civics teacher. We have a professor of history from Marquette University. And we have a director of a museum, the museum in Milton, the Milton House, one of my favorite museums, who the vast majority of Milwaukeeans have no idea even exists. And it's a pretty important piece in American history, a very important piece of American civics that people aren't even aware of. So we're hoping to get these individuals into the same room and to have these conversations and to, you know, brainstorm. We don't have all the answers, and we want educators to show up. We want students to show up. We want just community members to show up and to share their views about how can we increase civics education and the way that we learn. So they did all the states in the country, right? And on this test, on these civics tests. And, you know, the test that did the poorest only had 21% of its citizenry pass the test. 21%, that was Louisiana, right? And the best was Vermont. Only 48% failed the test. And that sounds only 48%, but that was number one in the country. That was number one. Wisconsin fell right there at about 50%. But, you know, that's troubling. That's troubling that these students aren't getting what they need. And so museums and educators, at least here in the state of Wisconsin, are trying to fill that gap.
Absolutely. Well, the work is just beginning. It's far from over. But Derek, I want to thank you so much for joining me today to have this important conversation.
Audrey, thank you for letting me come on and talk about this important conversation.
Derek Mosley is the director of Marquette University's Lubar Center and will be moderating the event On the Issues, Museums and Civic Education on January 23rd. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. You can find more information on the event at wuwm.com. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. Later in the show, we'll tell you about the documentary, The League. It shares the journey of the Negro Leagues through archival footage and never-before-seen interviews with some legendary baseball players. But first, a group of Milwaukeeans shared their approach to beating the winter blues by staying active. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM,
I'm Joy Powers. When it's this cold, we might find ourselves hibernating, staying inside where it's warm and cozy. But unfortunately, we can't just hide inside during the winter months. For this month's group chat, we hear from Milwaukeeans about the benefits of getting outside and how they do it. Here's Aaron Whitney, Mia Noel, and Ja'Kai Ali.
I think the main thing that surprises people that I do in the winter is run in the cold with a group of Black men, specifically Black men, surprises people because, you know, our community isn't so active in that way on a consistent basis.
I think I've tried almost everything. The consistent things I do are probably swimming, which is not outside, but I enjoy doing it in winter because I like to be, like, hydrated. I like the little, like, sauna hot tub time afterwards at the gym. I feel like my whole body feels warm. I think other stuff, I've tried swimming outside in the winter. I've done the polar plunge. Mm. I've done all kinds of different things. They're not maybe for me consistently, but I gave them a shot, you know.
You did
like,
it.
People do this, so let me try it out.
My ways of getting outside are the warm winter walks. They're not warm at all, but I like kind of try to like frame that in my brain of like, how lucky are we? And we'll get to that later, but maybe I'll try like cross-country skiing every once in a while. That feels very like I'm doing something today. Am I great at it? No. And that's not what we're there for, but we do a little bit of that. I try to like get people to have parties outside with me. They're not parties. We're going for a walk. But if you frame it as a party, it's maybe a little misleading once they get there. Of like, no, we're just walking to beer line. But those might be surprising surprises.
Tell us about those parties.
I think we could like co-plan a party right here. This running thing. Well, I'll say the little parties, they're really nothing. It's just like, come with me. We're going to do this like activity outside. I think we all get really stuck inside.
Yeah.
Or we wait for plans to kind of happen, and we don't really centralize outside as the place to be
right. For
like many reasons of accessibility or just like it's cold. And frankly, for myself personally, it's actually not easy either. People might look to like folks who work outside. I'm like pointing to Mia or who engage with like gang community members outside. For me, it's not the simple go. But so these little parties are like, hey, folks. We're all going for a big ol' walk at 4 o'clock today, and that's it. And just like group chat pressure a little
bit.
But
the messaging, you know, it sounds, you know, real intentional. You said warm winter walks. That sounds like
we're really working on the framing there as well. Of like, I get to go for a nice little walk because those first 5 minutes, you gotta push through. For me personally, it's not warm. Maybe we're not selling this whole outside time for the first 5 minutes, but I swear, if you stick through it with a nice cozy coffee, you just got to keep your head down until you get that like warmth going in your layers, and then eventually it gets nice.
Mm.
Have faith, maybe. Have faith those first five. So can I ask, like, say your group one morning, they're like, Ja'Kai, you know, this is the limit, mid-February, blustering winds.
Right.
Would you have the same, like, we got to keep going? Like, would you still go out? Or is it you're doing it because you're with this group?
I like that question. First and foremost, I do it for myself. We go out once a week on Saturdays, either Saturday around noon or 6:30 when it's, you know, at this time of year, pitch black. And it's simple, but it's not easy. I got that from Will Smith, and we can dive into that.
It's like running in the dark.
We have headlamps, but that one is easier because you've had all day to mentally prepare. On a more consistent basis is wake up as early as sometimes 5 o'clock when I can, you know, pull myself up to do that. In these past, just Monday and Tuesday, yesterday and the day before, 9 degrees at 5 o'clock in the morning.
You got a lot of head nods going on in this room here.
Yeah.
Wild stuff. I love it.
And it's more about doing it for myself.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, if I do it, I'm rewarded by all the benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And if I don't do it, I'm affected by all of the ailments, so to say.
Mm.
You know, it's like now I don't have the same energy. I don't have the same boost and you know, blood flow and endorphins and whatnot. You know, all the cool language. But it's just two sides to that coin.
So Mia, I'm introducing you. Mia works with getting folks outside all the time in the parks. But also, I heard you like organized walks with friends. Like, we're doing this big old walkaroo.
Yeah, I mean, I've only been working for the park for like 2.5 years. So well before that, I was big on getting people outside in the winter. And it's like very selfish. It's that having beautiful other people to be outside in the winter helps me get outside, right, breathe fresh air, socialize, not just making soup, which is a delightful winter activity.
It is.
But I've been organizing walks with friends. I've done Winter Olympics, which are just like a full day of wow outside winter activities just for fun with friends. Like, mm-hmm, we're going to have a hot drinks competition and a snow sculpture competition and a freestyle sledding competition just for fun. A couple of years ago, I really started pushing an idea of like BWE with my people as well, which is that every winter has the potential to be the best winter ever. Mm. And if you go into the winter feeling like this winter could be the best winter ever, mm, instead of being like, oh,
right, right,
winter's around the corner, this is the time where everything is bad.
Yeah.
If you like change the mentality a little bit, it helps me a lot.
How big of a role does seasonal depression or, you know, that aspect play in, you know, what y'all are doing, mm-hmm, and you know, what y'all aspire to do?
One of the big pushes of it's time to like start planning those walks is I'm at the point where we're like anticipating that like winter's coming. So I like, mm-hmm, that Mia has this attitude of, yay, it's coming.
Game
and sometimes you just gotta like, you just gotta like fake it till you make it sometimes. For me, it was this realization of like, I could move somewhere warmer, or I have to realize like, this is gonna be half of our year,
right,
every year.
Right.
We cannot just throw out half of our year. I think sometimes I fall into like the little participant category where I'm like, so what are we all doing? Who's going to like put it on the calendar? But I think being the friend, like today is soup day. That's it. There's no explanation. Just get here. Maybe I have soup for you. Maybe I don't. But we'll figure it out with those lures. But yeah, because those winter blues are so real. And, you know, getting outside for walks does not fix it all. But it kind of supports this like more stable, possibly stabilizing. Like every morning on the weekday, I go for a walk that's right this long. I get to the blue bench and then I turn around. Mm-hmm. It's like a little vitamin. It's just like a support for other stuff and mental health that you can work on. What about y'all?
It plays a huge role in like evolution of my mentality towards, mm-hmm, winter. Like I moved back to Wisconsin after college. And it was like the most depressed I'd ever been for, mm-hmm, like 6 months. And I graduated in December, so it was winter time. Similarly, like I live in Wisconsin. Unless I'm moving somewhere else, I have to figure out how to like be active and connected in winter, even though this is a time where a lot of people like move indoors. And so to do that, I started trying out like a lot of winter activities. I didn't grow up doing those. I didn't grow up snowshoeing or cross-country skiing or, mm-hmm, any of those things. But I was like, you know, it's a winter activity. That's what people do. I should try and do those things. I really love sledding. When my husband and I first started dating, I would be like, let's go for a quick sled after work.
A
so like
quick sled.
A quick sled. Mm-hmm. Because when you're an adult and you don't have a lot of endurance, sledding is hard. You know, like walk up and down a hill, you know, and after like 30 minutes, you're like, that's good. But those 30 minutes are so fun. So we would get on our like snow gear and we would go sled for like 30 minutes. And then he'd go to his house and I'd go to my house. And it'd be like, that was really cool. That
just
was fun. Just a quick sled after work. Not a big commitment. Not a we're out here for 4 hours. Just a quick sled.
The start of a great relationship, folks, is just some quick sleds.
Just, you know,
taking notes.
And it's interesting that you say just 30 minutes because, you know, that short amount of time can do so much for your day. And I'll answer that question for myself. Seasonal depression, you know, especially for these runs, has been a key inspiration. Living in Milwaukee my whole life, I've hated the winter. I grew up taking a bus, and I still take the bus, you know, on a consistent basis. Being outside has become a chore. It's frustrating to look forward to, but you said something, you know, key, Aaron. You said, this is half of the year. Am I going to waste half of the year, I guess, succumbing to the elements? And knowing that you know, just like I said, it's two sides of that coin. Either I do it and I'm rewarded, or I don't do it and I have to have whatever that looks like. That's been one of the prime inspirations for myself.
What advice would you give other folks who are trying to get outside a little more in winter?
I'm always here for, like, start small and, like, celebrate that. And give yourself some nice, like, preparations. Like, it is not pleasant going outside in a sweatshirt and sweatpants. That's not what I look like here today. We are wearing the tucked-in shirt under the sweatshirt with the pant. Like, I don't need to give y'all a fit check, but give yourself layers, like, bundle up. And I know that feels like a lot of work, but that little preparation is going to make that post 5-minute walk real nice and cozy. Or pairing it, a sommelier of walks, like, pair a walk with, like, your, we all were starting here, you're pairing your walk with, like, a coffee shop, or, like, sometimes I will, that's those walk parties of, like, we're going to go walk to get coffee, or I'll intentionally, like, pick a spot where we can, like, go wave to the river and then turn around. Those are really nice. But I think the biggest thing is doing it with others, like, finding kind of, like, a pal. And then just, like, doing as much as you can and letting them know that, too. Like, we are not here to, like, climb a mountain.
For one, small wins. You got to celebrate those. I quoted Will Smith earlier, and I said, it's simple, but it's not easy. On paper, walking or running, you know, 1 mile, you've done that a billion times. It's very simple, but when you add, you know, certain factors, it might seem difficult. And it might be difficult, quite frankly. But, you know, just doing it. You know, the hardest part is starting. Sometimes you got to muster up every ounce of emotional intelligence you got so that you can overcome whatever barrier that you might be facing internally and realize that, you know, it's so much better on the other side.
I'd say if I had advice to give, it's like, one, if you're just going solo and that's okay, try and notice how you feel after something. Try and notice, like, the things on walks or what's happening outdoors. See, like, what birds you can see, or look at, like, buds on trees that are, you know, promises of spring, like all these, like, really beautiful things that you see in the winter that you can only see in the winter. And then if you are a person who's looking for a community, there's, like, all these different ways that you can, like, plug in and tap in. You can go to Havenwood State Forest, you can go to Urban Ecology Center, you could go to nearby nature events. There's all these people doing, like, free cool stuff in the city, like, pretty much every single week, that's supporting getting outside, getting active, being connected to community. So those are really good things. And then I think on, like, a very basic level, don't wear cotton close to your skin.
Let's do that one more for that.
Right? You want to dress warm. You want to dress in layers. You don't want to have cotton be the nearest, closest part to your skin because it traps moisture, and moisture makes you feel cold. So, like, at a very basic level, like, sometimes I talk to people about what they wear because they may think, like, oh, I have to wear something. Like, I got to go out and buy really expensive things. No. I have to have,
just put,
like,
on all 13 of your shirts and go outside.
You know? And that nearest shirt should be, like, your exercise layer. You're, like, you know, your base layer is important. So, yeah, you don't have to have the coolest mountain climbing gear to get outside. You just have to dress warmly. And it makes a huge difference, right? Staying dry makes a big difference in how much you enjoy being outside.
That was Aaron Whitney, Mia Noel, and Ja'Kai Ali. Group Chat is our monthly segment featuring local voices and is produced by WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Coming up next, we'll learn about The League, a documentary all about the history of the Negro baseball leagues. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect
on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Are you familiar with the Milwaukee Bears? They were a Negro National League team that only played for one baseball season here in 1923. But although their tenure here was short, they're part of a larger legacy. The Negro Leagues were the catalysts for some of the world's best athletes and served as an important economic and social pillar for Black communities around the country. A documentary called The League dives into the journey, triumphs, and challenges of the Negro Leagues through the first half of the 20th century. Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski is joined by producer Byron Motley and executive producer Josh Green to talk about the film.
This film is dedicated to Bob Motley, who was a Negro Leagues umpire and co-author of the book The Negro Baseball Leagues. Byron, you of course wrote this book along with your father, Bob. Can you share a bit more about your intimate connection with this project and how it came to life on screen?
Well, it's been a labor of love the last 24 years I've worked on this project. So I started working on this project 24 years ago, doing interviews with former players and the last living umpire, of course, my father, and just kind of piecing the story together as best I could from the stories I got from all these great men and women who are part of the history of the leagues. But I loved hearing my father's stories about the experiences had with Satchel and Buck O'Neill and some of these great athletes. So I grew up around that history. The older I got, the more I thought about it and really appreciated the stories, is that not everybody knows these stories, which got me thinking there's probably more to this story than what I've even heard from him. So that's kind of how this process began.
So this documentary covers a wide span of baseball history, starting after the Civil War up to the 1950s, to show, most importantly, that Black players have always been a part of and central to baseball. The tone is joyous, it's celebratory, and I imagine it was made with the same sense. Can you share what you all felt was most important, or perhaps what was your personal guiding mission that helped you with the editorial process?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think everybody had a passion for the story, for the subjects, for getting this out to the world. And this particular movie, there were, in all honesty, there were a lot of cooks in the kitchen, which happens on movies. You need a lot of people to do a lot of different things. But I think the spirit of, again, and the passion of the stories themselves, of the characters, of what we knew there was a bigger mission there. And I think we all did our best to work together to make the best movie that we could make. And the guiding spirit really drove all of us that this was something bigger than any of us, and that we were doing Bob Motley justice, and we had to do the Negro Leagues justice, because we knew how important it was. So I think that drove us to really put our heads together and do the hard work and get to where we got. So it wasn't easy, but we made it.
Yeah, I think it was just to really tell as much of the story as possible, because there's so many stories in the Negro Leagues about the Negro Leagues, because we only hit the tip of the iceberg for all the other stories that are woven in this incredible history. That was the idea, the concept for me from the very beginning, was to tell as much of the story as possible so that people can be inspired by and be excited about, and then go out and read more and learn more about this history.
With any sports documentary, and I think you guys do this really well, it's easy to focus on only what happens on the diamond, the players, the internal ecosystem. But what the league explores really well is the whole ecosystem that the Negro League impacts. And I think it's very important to explain for anyone who will be seeing this soon and learning more that you especially take care to note that a successful Black baseball team meant that there was often a successful Black community built around it in all the cities that the league was in.
Absolutely. Well, it had to have that community to make it a success. And at the time, baseball was king. Everybody in the country, I think, loved baseball. If you didn't like baseball, you respected it because you knew what it meant to other people. So the Black community was no different than that. And like I said, it was just heaven, as my father would say, to be at a Negro League baseball game, because everybody was dressed to the nines. Everybody was looking good and ready to have a good time. And they would come out for a doubleheader. And want to say for a triple header, if there was one playing, you know, they just loved that game. It was like great fun for everybody. Just fun. And that's the one thing I kept talking to the team about, is that we need to, for this documentary, to show the fun, because that's what Negro League baseball was all about.
Yeah, and I think it was, just to add on, I agreed. That was a huge part of what, you know, Byron wanted to convey. And because this obviously, as you know, you could have, and we dealt with, it's a serious topic, American history and what segregation and, you know, all these things were very, you know, lynchings and, you know, it's very intense what happened to these neighborhoods. So it could have been a dark movie. And I think Byron was always the balance of saying, yes, we have to present, you know, how baseball history mirrors American history and how, what the obstacles were to, you know, to that business, to building that. And it shows how incredible it was that they built that business despite all those obstacles. I mean, third largest, you know, Black enterprise, you know, incredible communities that were doing very, very well because of the Negro Leagues. And I think, you know, but it was also important to balance it with, you know, the challenges and the tragedies and the, you know, the gravitas of that time period and what these players went through, you know, to play four games in a day or whatever it was, and to do it with a smile on their face, you know, because, it, as we say in the movie, it wasn't about the money or getting famous. It was, I mean, they wanted to play ball, you know. Yeah. So it's just a big testament to everybody involved in the Negro Leagues. And I think, you know, the other part for me was that what blew me away was that, you know, like, I think everybody just assumed integration was just 1,000% positive, you know, and I think that was a big part of why everybody kind of got on this train of like, I didn't know there were all these negative repercussions of that still exist today. Mm-hmm. So some of those communities that never recovered once those Negro League teams shut down and integration happened, it still has gone on today. And we say that briefly in the movie, in a sentence, in New York, in big cities, in New York, in Chicago and Philly. So I think it's those repercussions have lasted to today. You know, integration wasn't perfect. A lot of people got hurt.
Even in Milwaukee, I'm sure.
Milwaukee, absolutely. I've only been there
a couple of times, but you take a drive around the streets and you drive through the Black neighborhood, and you'll see these dilapidated buildings are still there. Been there for 40, 50, 60, 70 years. Why is that? You know, it's still there. You see it everywhere. And there's no sense for that. It makes no sense. Why isn't somebody putting money into that and making it rebuild and regain its energy? Just some things just haven't changed.
For both of you, after having spent so much time on this project, what's the enduring importance of the Negro Leagues for you that you hope audiences will take away?
Keep the spirit alive. Keep learning about it yourself. Never let it end. There's so much great history. It's up to all of us. It's up to all of us to keep the spirit alive. That's what Buck O'Neill told me during the first interview I did with him. He said, it's up to you. You're doing this. It's up to you to tell the story and do it, and do it the right way.
I think for me, it's the game today is played because of the Negro Leagues and the style of play and the what the players created, what those people like Rube Foster and the managers and executives created, this style of game, that is what is played today. So the impact on the game itself that the Negro Leagues had, and, you know, we didn't really even mention this in the movie, but the Negro Leagues players played in Asia. They were brought over to Japan to play. So, you know, the impact of even on baseball globally by the Negro Leagues, you can't calculate. I mean, they might be the reason baseball's so big in Asia right now.
No doubt.
Yeah, not to mention the impact on having Latina players
Latin America
in the game, which is huge now. That was not allowed back then. So I think it's the impact on the game, but I also think it's just I think it's like Byron said, it's all about the truth and understanding history for what it was, understanding, you know, the important people, you know, that impacted history, and getting it accurate, and not only conveying the fun, of course, of all of it, and the fact that under incredibly difficult circumstances, the Black community built this incredible business that changed the world. But I think it's getting history right. And we're living in an age where, you know, facts are debated now, and history books are being, you know, things are left out and rewritten, and depending on politics and whatever. And to me, it's like this story needed to be presented factually and as authentically and honestly as possible. And that's super important to me, that people know our real history. And I hope people take that away from it.
Byron Motley is a producer, and Josh Green is an executive producer of The League. They spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in 2023. You can stream the film on Hulu. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. If saving money was one of your goals for 2025, we've got some advice on how to do it tomorrow on Lake Effect. Plus, we'll share some ways you can help birds in the winter. And thank you so much for joining us right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.